Side 2.
He swung himself off the couch. He brushed himself down. He looked at Arthur, who was singing quietly to himself. He looked at the screen and recognised nothing. He looked at Slarty Bartfast. "How far did we just travel?" he said. "About," said Slarty Bartfast, "about two-thirds of the way across the galactic disk, I would say. Roughly, yes, roughly two-thirds, I think." "It's a strange thing," said Arthur quietly, "that the further and faster one travels across the universe, the more one's position in it seems to be largely immaterial, and one is filled with a profound, or rather, emptied of a..." "Yes, very strange," said Ford. "Where are we going?" "We are going," said Slarty Bartfast, "to confront an ancient nightmare of the universe." "And where are you going to drop us off?" "I will need your help." "Tough. Look, there's somewhere you can take us where we can have fun. I'm trying to think of it. We can get drunk and maybe listen to some extremely evil music. Hold on, I'll look it up." He dug out his copy of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and zipped through those parts of the index primarily concerned with sex and drugs and rock and roll. "A curse has arisen from the mists of time," said Slarty Bartfast. "Yes, I expect so," said Ford. "Hey," he said, lighting accidentally on one particular reference entry, "Eccentrica Galumbitz. Did you ever meet her? The triple-breasted whore of Eroticon 6. Some people say her erogenous zones start some 4 miles from her actual body. Me, I disagree. I say 5. "A curse," said Slarty Bartfast, "which will engulf the galaxy in fire and destruction and possibly bring the universe to a premature doom. I mean it," he added. "Sounds like a bad time," said Ford. "With luck, I'll be drunk enough not to notice." "Here," he said, stabbing his finger at the screen on the guide, "would be a really wicked place to go, and I think we should. What do you say, Arthur? Stop mumbling mantras and pay attention. There's some important stuff you're missing here." Arthur pushed himself up from his couch and shook his head. "Where are we going?" he said. "To confront an ancient..." "Oh, can it," said Ford. "Arthur, we're going to go out into the galaxy and have some fun. Is that an idea you can cope with?" "What's Slarty Bartfast looking so anxious about?" said Arthur. "Oh, nothing," said Ford. "Doom," said Slarty Bartfast. "Come," he added with sudden authority. "There is much I must show and tell you." He walked towards a green wrought-iron spiral staircase set incomprehensibly in the middle of the flight deck and started to ascend. Arthur, with a frown, followed. Ford slung the guide sullenly back into its satchel. "My doctor says that I have a malformed public duty gland and a natural deficiency in moral fibre," he muttered to himself, "and that I am therefore excused from saving universes." Nevertheless, he stomped up the stairs behind them. What they found upstairs was just stupid, or so it seemed, and Ford shook his head, buried his face in his hands, and slumped against a pot plant, crushing it against the wall. "The central computational area," said Slarty Bartfast, unperturbed. "This is where every calculation affecting the ship in any way is performed. Yes, I know what it looks like, but it is in fact a complex four-dimensional topographical map of a series of highly complex mathematical functions." "It looks like a joke," said Arthur. "I know what it looks like," said Slarty Bartfast, and went into it. As he did so, Arthur had a sudden vague flash of what it might mean, but he refused to believe it. The universe could not possibly work like that, he thought to himself. Cannot possibly. That, he thought to himself, would be as absurd as... absurd as... He terminated that line of thinking. Most of the really absurd things he could think of had already happened. And this was one of them. It was a large glass cage or box, in fact, a room. In it was a table, a long one. Around it were gathered about a dozen chairs of the Bentwood style. On it was a tablecloth, a grubby red and white check tablecloth, scarred with the occasional cigarette burn, each presumably at a precisely calculated mathematical position. And on the tablecloth sat some dozen half-eaten Italian meals, hedged about with half-eaten breadsticks and half-drunk glasses of wine, and toyed with listlessly by robots. It was all completely artificial. The robot customers were attended by a robot waiter, a robot wine waiter, and a robot maitre d'. The furniture was artificial, the tablecloth artificial, and each particular piece of food was clearly capable of exhibiting all the mechanical characteristics of, say, a pollo sorpreso, without actually being one. And all participated in a little dance together, a complex routine involving the manipulation of menus, bill pads, wallets, checkbooks, credit cards, watches, pencils, and paper napkins, which seemed to be hovering constantly on the edge of violence, but never actually getting anywhere. Slarty Bartfast hurried in, and then appeared to pass the time of day quite idly with the maitre d', whilst one of the customer robots, an auto-Rory, slid slowly under the table, mentioning what he intended to do to some guy over some girl. Slarty Bartfast took over the seat which had been thus vacated, and passed a shrewd eye over the menu. The tempo of the routine around the table seemed somehow imperceptibly to quicken. Arguments broke out. People attempted to prove things on napkins. They waved fiercely at each other and attempted to examine each other's pieces of chicken. The waiter's hand began to move on the bill pad more quickly than a human hand could manage, and then more quickly than human eye could follow. The pace accelerated. Soon, an extraordinary and insistent politeness overwhelmed the group. And seconds later, it seemed that a moment of consensus was suddenly achieved. A new vibration thrilled through the ship. Slarty Bartfast emerged from the glass room. "Bistromathics," he said, "the most powerful computational force known to parascience. Come to the room of informational illusions." He swept past and carried them bewildered in his wake. Chapter 7. The bistromathic drive is a wonderful new method of crossing vast interstellar distances without all that dangerous mucking about with improbability factors. Bistromathics itself is simply a revolutionary new way of understanding the behaviour of numbers. Just as Einstein observed that time was not an absolute but depended on the observer's movement in space, and that space was not an absolute but depended on the observer's movement in time, so it is now realized that numbers are not absolute but depend on the observer's movement in restaurants. The first non-absolute number is the number of people for whom the table is reserved. This will vary during the course of the first three telephone calls to the restaurant, and then bear no apparent relation to the number of people who actually turn up, or to the number of people who subsequently join them after the show, match, party, or gig, or to the number of people who leave when they see who else has turned up. The second non-absolute number is the given time of arrival, which is now known to be one of those most bizarre of mathematical concepts, a reciprovirsex cluson, a number whose existence can only be defined as being anything other than itself. In other words, the given time of arrival is the one moment of time at which it is impossible that any member of the party will arrive. Reciprovirsex clusons now play a vital part in many branches of maths, including statistics and accountancy, and also form the basic equation used to engineer the somebody else's problem field. The third and most mysterious piece of non-absoluteness of all lies in the relationship between the number of items on the bill, the cost of each item, the number of people at the table, and what they are each prepared to pay for. The number of people who have actually brought any money is only a sub-phenomenon in this field. The baffling discrepancies which used to occur at this point remained uninvestigated for centuries simply because no one took them seriously. They were at the time put down to such things as politeness, rudeness, meanness, flashness, tiredness, emotionality, or the lateness of the hour, and completely forgotten about on the following morning. They were never tested under laboratory conditions, of course, because they never occurred in laboratories, not in reputable laboratories at least. And so it was only with the advent of pocket computers that the startling truth became finally apparent, and it was this. Numbers written on restaurant bills within the confines of restaurants do not follow the same mathematical laws as numbers written on any other pieces of paper in any other parts of the universe. This single fact took the scientific world by storm. It completely revolutionized it. So many mathematical conferences got held in such good restaurants that many of the finest minds of a generation died of obesity and heart failure, and the science of maths was put back by years. Slowly, however, the implications of the idea began to be understood. To begin with, it had been too stark, too crazy, too much what the man in the street would have said, "Oh yes, I could have told you that about." Then some phrases like interactive subjectivity frameworks were invented, and everybody was able to relax and get on with it. The small groups of monks who had taken up hanging around the major research institutes, singing strange chants to the effect that the universe was only a figment of its own imagination, were eventually given a street theatre grant and went away. Chapter 8. In space travel, you see, said Slarty Bartfast as he fiddled with some instruments in the room of informational illusions, in space travel... He stopped and looked about him. The room of informational illusions was a welcome relief after the visual monstrosities of the central computational area. There was nothing in it. No information, no illusions, just themselves. White walls, and a few small instruments which looked as if they were meant to plug into something which Slarty Bartfast couldn't find. Yes, urged Arthur. He had picked up Slarty Bartfast's sense of urgency, but didn't know what to do with it. Yes, what? Said the old man. You were saying... Slarty Bartfast looked at him sharply. The numbers, he said, are awful. He resumed his search. Arthur nodded wisely to himself. After a while, he realized that this wasn't getting him anywhere, and he decided that he would say, What? After all. In space travel, repeated Slarty Bartfast, all the numbers are awful. Arthur nodded again and looked round to Ford for help, but Ford was practising being sullen and getting quite good at it. "'I was only,' said Slarty Bartfast with a sigh, "'trying to save you the trouble of asking me why all the ship's computations were being done on a waiter's bill pad.' Arthur frowned. "'Why,' he said, "'were all the ship's computations being done on a wa—' He stopped. Slarty Bartfast said, Because in space travel all the numbers are awful. He could tell that he wasn't getting his point across. Listen, he said, on a waiter's bill pad numbers dance. You must have encountered the phenomenon. Well, on a waiter's bill pad, said Slarty Bartfast, reality and unreality collide on such a fundamental level that each becomes the other and anything is possible within certain parameters. What parameters? It's impossible to say, said Slarty Bartfast. That's one of them. Strange, but true. At least I think it's strange, he added, and I am assured that it's true. At that moment, he located the slot in the wall for which he had been searching, and clicked the instrument he was holding into it. Do not be alarmed, he said, and then suddenly darted an alarmed look at it himself and lunged back. It's... They didn't hear what he said, because at that moment the ship winked out of existence around them, and a star battleship the size of a small Midlands industrial city plunged out of the sundered night towards them, star lasers ablaze. A nightmare storm of blistering light seared through the blackness and smacked a fair bit off the planet directly behind them. They gaped, pop-eyed, and were unable to scream. Chapter 9. Another world, another day, another dawn. The early morning's thinnest sliver of light appeared silently. Several billion trillion tons of super-hot exploding hydrogen nuclei rose slowly above the horizon and managed to look small, cold, and slightly damp. There is a moment in every dawn when light floats. There is the possibility of magic. Creation holds its breath. The moment passed as it regularly did on Squanchula Ceta, without incident. The mist clung to the surface of the marshes. The swamp trees were grey with it, the tall reeds indistinct. It hung motionless like held breath. Nothing moved. There was silence. The sun struggled feebly with the mist, tried to impart a little warmth here, shed a little light there, but clearly today was going to be just another long haul across the sky. Nothing moved. Again, silence. Nothing moved. Silence. Nothing moved. Very often on Squanchula Ceta, whole days would go on like this, and this was indeed going to be one of them. 14 hours later, the sun sank hopelessly beneath the opposite horizon with a sense of totally wasted effort. And a few hours later, it reappeared, squared its shoulders, and started on up the sky again. This time, however, something was happening. A mattress had just met a robot. Hello, robot, said the mattress. Bleh, said the robot, and continued what it was doing. which was walking round very slowly in a very tiny circle. "Happy?" said the mattress. The robot stopped and looked at the mattress. It looked at it quizzically. It was clearly a very stupid mattress. It looked back at him with wide eyes. After what it had calculated to 10 significant decimal places as being the precise length of pause most likely to convey a general contempt for all things mattressy, the robot continued to walk around in tight circles. "We could have a conversation," said the mattress. "Would you like that?" It was a large mattress, and probably one of quite high quality. Very few things actually get manufactured these days, because in an infinitely large universe, such as, for instance, the one in which we live, most things one could possibly imagine, and a lot of things one would rather not, grow somewhere. A forest was discovered recently, in which most of the trees grew ratchet screwdrivers as fruit. The life cycle of a ratchet screwdriver is quite interesting. Once picked, it needs a dark, dusty drawer in which it can lie undisturbed for years. Then one night it suddenly hatches, discards its outer skin, which crumbles into dust, and emerges as a totally unidentifiable little metal object with flanges at both ends and a sort of ridge and a sort of hole for a screw. This, when found, will get thrown away. No one knows what it's supposed to gain from this. Nature, in her infinite wisdom, is presumably working on it. No one really knows what mattresses are meant to gain from their lives, either. They are large, friendly, pocket-sprung creatures which live quiet, private lives in the marshes of Squanchula Zeta. Many of them get caught, slaughtered, dried out, shipped out, and slept on. None of them seem to mind this, and all of them are called Zem. "No," said Marvin. "My name," said the mattress, "is Zem. We could discuss the weather a little." Marvin paused again in his weary circular plod. "The dew," he observed, "has clearly fallen with a particularly sickening thud this morning." He resumed his walk, as if inspired by this conversational outburst, to fresh heights of gloom and despondency. He plodded tenaciously. If he had had teeth, he would have gritted them at this point. He hadn't. He didn't. The mere plod said it all. The mattress flopped around. This is a thing that only live mattresses and swamps are able to do, which is why the word is not in more common usage. It flopped in a sympathetic sort of way, moving a fairish body of water as it did so. It blew a few bubbles up through the water engagingly. Its blue and white stripes glistened briefly in a sudden feeble ray of sun that had unexpectedly made it through the mist, causing the creature to bask momentarily. Marvin plodded. "You have something on your mind, I think," said the mattress floopily.
"More than you can possibly imagine," jeered Marvin. "My capacity for mental activity of all kinds is as boundless as the infinite reaches of space itself, except, of course, for my capacity for happiness." Stomp, stomp, he went. "My capacity for happiness," he added, "you could fit into a matchbox without taking out the matches first."
The mattress globbered. This is the noise made by a live, swamp-dwelling mattress that is deeply moved by a story of personal tragedy. The word can also, according to the ultra-complete Maximegalon Dictionary of Every Language Ever, mean the noise made by the Lord High Sandvalvewag of Hollop on discovering that he has forgotten his wife's birthday for the second year running. Since there was only ever one Lord High Sandvalvewag of Hollop and he never married, the word is only ever used in a negative or speculative sense, and there is an ever-increasing body of opinion which holds that the ultra-complete Maximegalon dictionary is not worth the fleet of lorries it takes to cart its micro-stored edition around in. Strangely enough, the dictionary omits the word floopily, which simply means in the manner of something which is floopy. The mattress globbered again. "I sense a deep dejectedness in your diodes," it volued, for the meaning of the word volue, by a copy of Squanchula Swamp Talk at any remaindered bookshop, or alternatively by the ultra-complete Maximegalon Dictionary, as the university will be very glad to get it off their hands and regain some valuable parking lots. "And it saddens me. You should be more mattress-like. We live quiet, retired lives in the swamp, and we are content to flollop and volue and regard the wetness in a fairly floopy manner. Some of us are killed, but all of us are called Zem, so we never know which. And globbering is thus kept to a minimum. Why are you walking in circles?"
"Because my leg is stuck," said Marvin simply.
It seems to me, said the mattress, eyeing it compassionately, that it is a pretty poor sort of leg.
You are right, said Marvin. It is.
Voon, said the mattress.
I expect so, said Marvin, and I also expect that you find the idea of a robot with an artificial leg pretty amusing. You should tell your friends Zem and Zem when you see them later. They'll laugh if I know them, which of course I don't, except in so far as I know all organic life forms, which is much better than I would wish to. Ah, but my life is but a box of worm gears.
He stomped around again in his tiny circle, around his thin steel peg leg, which revolved in the mud but seemed otherwise stuck.
"But why do you just keep walking round and round?" said the mattress.
"Just to make the point," said Marvin, and continued round and round.
"Consider it made, my dear friend," flurbled the mattress. "Consider it made."
"Just another 1,000,000 years," said Marvin. "Just another quick 1,000,000. Then I might try it backwards, just for the variety, you understand."
The mattress could feel in his innermost spring pockets that the robot dearly wished to be asked how long he had been trudging around in this futile and fruitless manner, and with another quiet flurble he did so.
"Oh, just over the 1.5 million mark, just over," said Marvin airily. "Ask me if I ever get bored. Go on, ask me."
The mattress did. Marvin ignored the question and merely trudged with added emphasis.
"I gave a speech once," he said suddenly and apparently unconnectedly. "You may not instantly see why I bring the subject up, but that is because my mind works so phenomenally fast, and I am at a rough estimate 30 billion times more intelligent than you. Let me give you an example. Think of a number, any number."
Five, said the mattress.
"Wrong," said Marvin. "You see?"
The mattress was much impressed by this, and realized that it was in the presence of a not unremarkable mind. It willamed along its entire length, sending excited little ripples through its shallow, algae-covered pool. It gupped.
"Tell me," it urged, "of the speech you once made. I long to hear it."
"It was received very badly," said Marvin, "for a variety of reasons. I delivered it," he added, pausing to make an awkward humping sort of gesture with his not exactly good arm, but his arm which was better than the other one, which was dishearteningly welded to his left side. "Over there, about a mile distance."
He was pointing, as well as he could manage, and he obviously wanted to make it totally clear that this was as well as he could manage, through the mist, over the reeds, to a part of the marsh which looked exactly the same as every other part of the marsh.
"There," he repeated. "I was somewhat of a celebrity at the time."
Excitement gripped the mattress. It had never heard of speeches being delivered on Squanchula Zeta, and certainly not by celebrities. Water splattered off it as a thrill glurried across its back. It did something which mattresses very rarely bother to do. Summoning every bit of its strength, it reared its oblong body, heaved it up into the air, and held it quivering there for a few seconds, whilst it peered through the mist over the reeds at the part of the marsh which Marvin had indicated, observing, without disappointment, that it was exactly the same as every other part of the marsh. The effort was too much, and it flodged back into its pool, deluging Marvin with smelly mud, moss, and weeds.
"I was a celebrity," droned the robot sadly, "for a short while on account of my miraculous and bitterly resented escape from a fate almost as good as death in the heart of a blazing sun. You can guess from my condition," he added, "how narrow my escape was. I was rescued by a scrap metal merchant. Imagine that. Here I am, brain the size of... Oh, never mind."
He trudged savagely for a few seconds.
"He it was who fixed me up with this leg. Hateful, isn't it? He sold me to a mind zoo. I was the star exhibit. I had to sit on a box and tell my story, whilst people told me to cheer up and think positive. 'Give us a grin, little robot,' they would shout at me. 'Give us a little chuckle.' I would explain to them that to get my face to grin would take a good couple of hours in a workshop with a wrench. And that went down very well."
"The speech," urged the mattress. "I long to hear of the speech you gave in the marshes."
"There was a bridge built across the marshes.
a cyber-structured hyperbridge, hundreds of miles in length, to carry iron buggies and freighters over the swamp.
A bridge? Quirrelled the mattress. Here in the swamp?
A bridge, confirmed Marvin, here in the swamp. It was going to revitalize the economy of the Squanchula system. They spent the entire economy of the Squanchula system building it. They asked me to open it. Poor fools.
It began to rain a little. A fine spray slid through the mist.
I stood on the platform, for hundreds of miles in front of me, and hundreds of miles behind me, the bridge stretched.
Did it glitter? Enthused the mattress.
It glittered.
Did it span the miles majestically?
It spanned the miles majestically.
Did it stretch like a silver thread far out into the invisible mist?
Yes, said Marvin. Do you want to hear the story?
I want to hear your speech, said the mattress.
This is what I said. I said, I would like to say that it is a very great pleasure, honour, and privilege for me to open this bridge, but I can't because my lying circuits are all out of commission. I hate and despise you all. I now declare this hapless cyberstructure open to the unthinking abuse of all who wantonly cross her. And I plug myself into the opening circuits.
Marvin paused, remembering the moment.
The mattress flurred and glurried. It flolloped and gupped and willamed, doing this last in a particularly floopy way. Voon, it whirfed at last. And was it a magnificent occasion?
Reasonably magnificent. The entire 1,000-mile-long bridge spontaneously folded up its glittering spans and sank weeping into the mire, taking everybody with it.
There was a sad and terrible pause at this point in the conversation, during which 100,000 people seemed unexpectedly to say whoop, and a team of white robots descended from the sky, like dandelion seeds drifting on the wind in tight military formation. For a sudden, violent moment, they were all there, in the swamp, wrenching Marvin's false leg off, and then they were gone again in their ship, which said foop.
"You see the sort of thing I have to contend with," said Marvin to the gobbering mattress.
Suddenly, a moment later, the robots were back again for another violent incident, and this time when they left, the mattress was alone in the swamp. He flopped around in astonishment and alarm. He almost lurgled in fear. He reared himself up to see over the reeds, but there was nothing to see. No robot, no glittering bridge, no ship, just more reeds. He listened. But there was no sound on the wind beyond the now familiar sound of half-crazed etymologists calling distantly to each other across the sullen mire.
Chapter 10. The body of Arthur Dent span. The universe shattered into a million glittering fragments around it, and each particular shard spanned silently through the void, reflecting on its silver surface some single, searing holocaust of fire and destruction. And then the blackness behind the universe exploded, and each particular piece of blackness was the furious smoke of hell. And the nothingness behind the blackness behind the universe erupted, and behind the nothingness behind the blackness behind the shattered universe was at last the dark figure of an immense man speaking immense words.
"These, then," said the figure, speaking from an immensely comfortable chair, "were the cricket wars, the greatest devastation ever visited upon our galaxy. What you have experienced..."
Slarty Bartfast floated past, waving.
"It's just a documentary," he called out. "This is not a good bit. Terribly sorry, trying to find the rewind control." "Is what billions upon billions of innocent..."
"Do not," called out Slarty Bartfast, floating past again and fiddling furiously with the thing that had stuck into the wall of the Room of Informational Illusions, and which was, in fact, still stuck there, "agree to buy anything at this point."
"People, creatures, your fellow beings..."
Music swelled. Again, it was immense music, immense chords, and behind the man, slowly, three tall pillars began to emerge out of the immensely swirling mist.
"Experienced, lived through, or more often failed to live through,
Think of that, my friends, and let us not forget, and in just a moment I shall be able to suggest a way which will help us always to remember that before the cricket wars, the galaxy was that rare and wonderful thing, a happy galaxy.
The music was going bananas with immensity at this point.
A happy galaxy, my friend, as represented by the symbol of the wicket gate.
The three pillars stood out clearly now. Three pillars topped with two cross pieces in a way which looked stupefyingly familiar to Arthur's addled brain.
"The three pillars," thundered the man. "The steel pillar which represented the strength and power of the galaxy."
Searchlights seared out and danced crazy dances up and down the pillar on the left, which was clearly made of steel or something very like it. The music thumped and bellowed.
"The perspex pillar," announced the man, "representing the forces of science and reason in the galaxy."
Other searchlights played exotically up and down the right-hand, transparent pillar, creating dazzling patterns within it, and a sudden, inexplicable craving for ice cream in the stomach of Arthur Dent.
"And," the thunderous voice continued, "the wooden pillar, representing,"
and here his voice became just very slightly hoarse with wonderful sentiments,
"the forces of nature and spirituality."
The lights picked out the central pillar. The music moved bravely up into the realms of complete unspeakability.
"Between them supporting," the voice rolled on, approaching its climax, "the golden bale of prosperity and the silver bale of peace."
The whole structure was now flooded with dazzling lights, and the music had now, fortunately, gone far beyond the limits of the discernible. At the top of the three pillars, the two brilliantly gleaming bales sat and dazzled. There seemed to be girls sitting on top of them, and maybe they were meant to be angels. Angels are usually represented as wearing more than that, though. Suddenly, there was a dramatic hush in what was presumably meant to be the cosmos, and a darkening of the lights.
"There is not a world," thrilled the man's expert voice, "not a civilized world in the galaxy, where this symbol is not revered even today. Even in primitive worlds, it persists in racial memories. This is what the forces of cricket destroyed, and this it is that now locks their world away till the end of eternity."
And with a flourish, the man produced in his hands a model of the wicket gate. Scale was terribly hard to judge in this whole extraordinary spectacle, but the model looked as if it must have been about 3 feet high.
"Not the original key, of course. That, as everyone knows, was destroyed, blasted into the ever-whirling eddies of the space-time continuum, and lost forever. This is a remarkable replica, hand-tooled by skilled craftsmen, lovingly assembled using ancient craft secrets into a memento you will be proud to own, in memory of those who fell, and in tribute to the galaxy, our galaxy, which they died to defend."
Slotty Bartfast floated past again at this moment. "Found it," he said. "We can lose all this rubbish. Just don't nod, that's all."
"Now let us all bow our heads in payment," intoned the voice,
and then said it again, much faster and backwards. Lights came and went. The pillars disappeared. The man gabbled himself backwards into nothing. The universe snappily reassembled itself around them.
You get the gist," said Slotty Bartfast.
"I'm astonished," said Arthur, "and bewildered." "I was asleep," said Ford, who floated into view at this point. "Did I miss anything?" They found themselves once again teetering rather rapidly on the edges of an agonizingly high cliff. The wind whipped out from their faces, and across a bay on which the remains of one of the greatest and most powerful space battle fleets ever assembled in the galaxy was briskly burning itself back into existence. The sky was a sullen pink, darkening via a rather curious colour to blue and upwards to black. Smoke billowed down out of it at an incredible lick. Events were now passing back by them almost too quickly to be distinguished, and when, a short while later, a huge star battleship rushed away from them as if they'd said boo, they only just recognised it as the point at which they'd come in. But now things were too rapid, a video-tactile blur which brushed and jiggled them through centuries of galactic history, turning, twisting, flickering. The sound was a mere thin trill. Periodically, throughout the thickening jumble of events, they sensed appalling catastrophes, deep horrors, cataclysmic shocks. And these were always associated with certain recurring images, the only images which ever stood out clearly from the avalanche of tumbling history. A wicket gate. A small, hard, red ball. Hard, white robots. And also something less distinct. Something dark and cloudy. There was also another sensation which rose clearly out of the trilling passage of time. Just as the slow series of clicks, when speeded up, will lose the definition of each individual click and gradually take on the quality of a sustained and rising tone, so a series of individual impressions here took on the quality of a sustained emotion, and yet not an emotion. If it was an emotion, it was a totally emotionless one. It was hatred. Implacable hatred. It was cold, not like ice is cold, but like a wall is cold. It was impersonal, not like a randomly flung fist in a crowd is impersonal, but like a computer-issued parking summons is impersonal. And it was deadly. Again, not like a bullet or a knife is deadly, but like a brick wall across a motorway is deadly. And just as a rising tone will change in character and take on harmonics as it rises, so again this emotionless emotion seemed to rise to an unbearable, if unheard, scream, and suddenly seemed to be a scream of guilt and failure. And suddenly, it stopped. They were left standing on a quiet hilltop on a tranquil evening. The sun was setting. All around them, softly undulating green countryside rolled off gently into the distance. Birds sang about what they thought of it all, and general opinion seemed to be good. A little way away could be heard the sound of children playing, and a little further away than the apparent source of that sound could be seen in the dimming evening light the outlines of a small town. The town appeared to consist mostly of fairly low buildings made of white stone. The skyline was of gentle, pleasing curves. The sun had nearly set. As if out of nowhere, music began. A voice said, "This!" Slarty Bartfast tugged at a switch, and it stopped. "I will tell you about it," he said quietly. The place was peaceful. Arthur felt happy. Even Ford seemed cheerful. They walked a short way in the direction of the town, and the informational illusion of the grass was pleasant and springy under their feet. And the informational illusion of the flowers smelt sweet and fragrant. Only Slarty Bartfast seemed apprehensive and out of sorts. He stopped and looked up. It suddenly occurred to Arthur that, coming as this did at the end, so to speak, or rather the beginning, of all the horror they had just blurrily experienced, something nasty must be about to happen. He was distressed to think that something nasty could happen to somewhere as idyllic as this. He too glanced up. There was nothing in the sky. "They're not about to attack here, are they?" he said. He realized that this was merely a recording he was walking through, but he still felt alarmed. "Nothing is about to attack here," said Slarty Bartfast in a voice which unexpectedly trembled with emotion. "This is where it all starts. This is the place itself. This is Cricket." He stared up into the sky. The sky, from one horizon to another, from east to west, from north to south, was utterly and completely black. Chapter 11. Stomp, stomp.
"We're pleased to be of service."
"Shut up."
"Thank you."
Stomp, 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 stomp.
"Whirr." "Thank you for making a simple door very happy."
"Hope your diodes rot."
"Thank you. Have a nice day."
Stomp, 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 stomp.
"Whirr." "It is my pleasure to open for you."
"Zarkov."
"And my satisfaction to close again with the knowledge of a job well done."
"I said Zarkov."
"Thank you for listening to this message."
Stomp, 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 stomp. Whoop. Zaphod stopped stomping. He'd been stomping around the Heart of Gold for days, and so far, no door had said whoop to him. He was fairly certain that no door had said whoop to him now. It was not the sort of thing that doors said, too concise. Furthermore, there were not enough doors. It sounded as if 100,000 people had said whoop, which puzzled him because he was the only person on the ship. It was dark. Most of the ship's non-essential systems were closed down. It was drifting idly in a remote area of the galaxy, deep in the inky blackness of space. So which particular 100,000 people would turn up at this point and say a totally unexpected whoop? He looked about him, up the corridor and down the corridor. It was all in deep shadow. There were just the very dim, pinkish outlines to the doors, which glowed in the dark and pulsed whenever they spoke, though he tried every way he could think of stopping them. The lights were off so that his heads could avoid looking at each other, because neither of them was currently a particularly engaging sight, and nor had they been since he had made the error of looking into his soul. It had indeed been an error. It had been late one night, of course. It had been a difficult day, of course. There had been soulful music playing on the ship's sound system, of course. And he had, of course, been slightly drunk. In other words, all the usual conditions which bring on a bout of soul-searching had applied, but it had nevertheless clearly been an error. Standing now silent and alone in the dark corridor, he remembered the moment and shivered. His one head looked one way and his other the other, and each decided that the other was the way to go. He listened but could hear nothing. All there had been was the whoop. It seemed an awfully long way to bring an awfully large number of people just to say one word. He started nervously to edge his way in the direction of the bridge. There at least he would feel in control. He stopped again. The way he was feeling, he didn't think he was an awfully good person to be in control. The first shock of that moment, thinking back, had been discovering that he actually had a soul. In fact, he'd always more or less assumed that he had one, as he had a full complement of everything else, and indeed two of some things. But suddenly actually to encounter the thing lurking there deep within him, given him a severe jolt. And then to discover, this was the second shock, that it wasn't the totally wonderful object which he felt a man in his position had a natural right to expect, had jolted him again. Then he had thought about what his position actually was, and the renewed shock had nearly made him spill his drink. He drained it quickly before anything serious happened to it. He then had another quick one to follow the first one down and check that it was all right. "Freedom," he said aloud. Trillian came onto the bridge at that point and said several enthusiastic things on the subject of freedom. "I can't cope with it," he said darkly, and sent a third drink down to see why the second hadn't yet reported on the condition of the first. He looked uncertainly at both of her and preferred the one on the right. He poured a drink down his other throat with the plan that it would head the previous one off at the pass, join forces with it, and together they would get the second to pull itself together. Then all three would go off in search of the first, give it a good talking to, and maybe a bit of a sing as well. He felt uncertain as to whether the fourth drink had understood all that, so he sent down a fifth to explain the plan more fully, and a sixth for moral support. "You're drinking too much," said Trillian. His heads collided, trying to sort out the four of her he could now see into a whole person. He gave up and looked at the navigation screen, and was astonished to see a quite phenomenal number of stars. "Excitement and adventure and really wild things," he muttered. "Look," she said in a sympathetic tone of voice, and sat down near him. "It's quite understandable that you're going to feel a little aimless for a bit." He boggled at her. Never seen anyone sit down on their own lap before. "Wow," he said. He had another drink. "You've finished the mission you've been on for years." "I haven't been on it. I've been trying to avoid being on it." "You've still finished it," he grunted. "It seemed to be a terrific party going on in his stomach." "I think it finished me," he said. "Here I am, Zaphod Beeblebrox. I can go anywhere, do anything. I have the greatest ship in the known sky, a girl with whom things seem to be working out pretty well." "Are they?" "As far as I can tell. I'm not an expert in personal relationships." Trillian raised her eyebrows.
I am, he added, one hell of a guy. I can do anything I want, only I just haven't the faintest idea what.
He paused. One thing, he further added, has suddenly ceased to lead to another, in contradiction of which he had another drink and slid graciously off his chair. Whilst he slept it off, Trillian did a little research in the ship's copy of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. It had some advice to offer on drunkenness. Go to it, it said, and good luck. It was cross-referenced to the entry concerning the size of the universe and ways of coping with that. Then she found the entry on Han Wavell, an exotic holiday planet and one of the wonders of the galaxy. Han Wavell is a world which consists largely of fabulous ultra-luxury hotels and casinos, all of which have been formed by the natural erosion of wind and rain. The chances of this happening are more or less one to infinity against. Little is known of how this came about, because none of the geophysicists, probability statisticians, meteor analysts, or bizarrologists who are so keen to research it can afford to stay there. Terrific, thought Trillian to herself, and within a few hours the great white running shoe ship was slowly powering down out of the sky beneath a hot, brilliant sun towards a brightly coloured sandy spaceport. The ship was clearly causing a sensation on the ground, and Trillian was enjoying herself. She heard Zaphod moving around and whistling somewhere in the ship. How are you? She said over the general intercom. Fine, he said brightly. Terribly well. Where are you? In the bathroom. What are you doing? Staying here. After an hour or two, it became plain that he meant it, and the ship returned to the sky without having once opened its hatchway. Hey-ho, said Eddie the computer. Trillian nodded patiently, tapped her fingers a couple of times, and pushed the intercom switch. I think that enforced fun is probably not what you need at this point. Probably not, replied Zaphod from wherever he was. I think a bit of a physical challenge would help draw you out of yourself. Whatever you think, I think, said Zaphod. Recreational Impossibilities was a heading which caught Trillian's eye when a short while later she sat down to flip through the guide again. And as the Heart of Gold rushed at improbable speeds in an indeterminate direction, she sipped a cup of something undrinkable from the Nutrimatic drinks dispenser and read about how to fly. The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy has this to say on the subject of flying. There is an art, it says, or rather a knack to flying. The knack lies in learning how to throw yourself at the ground and miss. Pick a nice day, it suggests, and try it. The first part is easy. All it requires is simply the ability to throw yourself forward with all your weight and the willingness not to mind that it's going to hurt. That is, it's going to hurt if you fail to miss the ground. Most people fail to miss the ground, and if they're really trying properly, the likelihood is that they will fail to miss it fairly hard. Clearly, it is the second part, the missing, which presents the difficulties. One problem is that you have to miss the ground accidentally. It's no good deliberately intending to miss the ground because you won't. You have to have your attention suddenly distracted by something else when you're halfway there, so that you're no longer thinking about falling or about the ground or about how much it's going to hurt if you fail to miss it. It is notoriously difficult to prize your attention away from these three things during the split second you have at your disposal. Hence, most people's failure and their eventual disillusionment with this exhilarating and spectacular sport. If, however, you are lucky enough to have your attention momentarily distracted at the crucial moment by, say, a gorgeous pair of legs, or tentacles, pseudopodia, according to phylum and or personal inclination, or a bomb going off in your vicinity, or by suddenly spotting an extremely rare species of beetle crawling along a nearby twig, then, in your astonishment, you will miss the ground completely and remain bobbing just a few inches above it in what might seem to be a slightly foolish manner. This is a moment for superb and delicate concentration. Bob and float, float and bob. Ignore all considerations of your own weight and simply let yourself waft higher. Do not listen to what anybody says to you at this point because they are unlikely to say anything helpful. They are most likely to say something along the lines of, "Good God, you can't possibly be flying." It is vitally important not to believe them or they will suddenly be right. Waft higher and higher. Try a few swoops, gentle ones at first, then drift above the treetops, breathing regularly.
Do not wave at anybody. When you have done this a few times, you'll find the moment of distraction rapidly becomes easier and easier to achieve. You will then learn all sorts of things about how to control your flight, your speed, your maneuverability, and the trick usually lies in not thinking too hard about whatever you want to do, but just allowing it to happen, as if it was going to anyway. You will also learn about how to land properly, which is something you will almost certainly cock up, and cock up badly, on your first attempt. There are private flying clubs you can join, which help you achieve the all-important moment of distraction. They hire people with surprising bodies or opinions to leap out from behind bushes and exhibit and or explain them at the critical moments. Few genuine hitchhikers will be able to afford to join these clubs, but some may be able to get temporary employment at them. Trillian read this longingly, but reluctantly decided that Zaphod wasn't really in the right frame of mind for attempting to fly, or for walking through mountains, or for trying to get the Brantisvogan Civil Service to acknowledge a change of address card, which were the other things listed under the heading Recreational Impossibilities. Instead, she flew the ship to Elosimana Sinica, a world of ice, snow, mind-hurtling beauty and stunning cold. The trek from the snow plains of Liska to the summit of the ice crystal pyramids of Sastantua is long and grueling, even with jet skis and a team of Sinica snowhounds, but the view from the top, a view which takes in the Stinn glacier fields, the shimmering prism mountains, and the far ethereal dancing ice lights, is one which first freezes the mind and then slowly releases it to hitherto unexperienced horizons of beauty. And Trillian, for one, felt that she could do with a bit of having her mind slowly released to hitherto unexperienced horizons of beauty. They went into a low orbit. There lay the silver-white beauty of Elosimania Sinica beneath them. Zaphod stayed in bed with one head stuck under a pillow and the other doing crosswords till late into the night. Trillian nodded patiently again, counted to a sufficiently high number, and told herself that the important thing now was just to get Zaphod talking. She prepared, by dint of deactivating all the robot kitchen synthematics, the most fabulously delicious meal she could contrive, delicately oiled meats, scented fruits, fragrant cheeses, fine Aldebaran wines. She carried it through to him and asked if he felt like talking things through. "Zarkov," said Zaphod. Trillian nodded patiently to herself, counted to an even higher number, tossed the tray lightly aside, walked to the transport room, and just teleported herself the hell out of his life. She didn't even program any coordinates. She hadn't the faintest idea where she was going. She just went, a random row of dots flowing through the universe. "Anything," she said to herself as she left, "is better than this." "Good job too," muttered Zaphod to himself, turned over and failed to go to sleep. The next day, he restlessly paced the empty corridors of the ship, pretending not to look for her, though he knew she wasn't there. He ignored the computer's querulous demands to know just what the hell was going on around here by fitting a small electronic gag across a pair of its terminals. After a while, he began to turn down the lights. There was nothing to see. Nothing was about to happen. Lying in bed one night, and night was now virtually continuous on the ship, he decided to pull himself together, to get things into some kind of perspective. He sat up sharply and started to pull clothes on. He decided that there must be someone in the universe feeling more wretched, miserable, and forsaken than himself, and he determined to set out and find him. Halfway to the bridge, it occurred to him that it might be Marvin, and he returned to bed. It was a few hours later than this, as he stomped disconsolately about the darkened corridors, swearing at cheerful doors, that he heard the whoop said, and it made him very nervous. He leant tensely against the corridor wall and frowned like a man trying to unbend a corkscrew by telekinesis. He laid his fingertips against the wall and felt an unusual vibration. And now he could quite clearly hear slight noises and could hear where they were coming from. They were coming from the bridge. Moving his hand along the wall, he came across something he was glad to find. He moved on a little further, quietly. "Computer?" he hissed. "Hmm?" said the computer terminal nearest him, equally quietly. "Is there someone on the ship?" "Hmm," said the computer. "Who is it?"
said the computer.
What?
Zaphod buried one of his faces in two of his hands.
Oh, Zarkon, he muttered to himself.
Then he stared up the corridor towards the entrance to the bridge in the dim distance, from which more and purposeful noises were coming, and in which the gagged terminals were situated.
Computer, he hissed again.
Hmm?
When I ungag you...
Hmm?
Remind me to punch myself in the mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Either one. Now just tell me this. One for yes, two for no. Is it dangerous?
Hmm.
It is?
Hmm.
You didn't just go, hmm, twice.
Hmm, hmm.
Hmm.
He inched his way up the corridor, as if he would rather be yarding his way down it, which was true. He was within 2 yards of the door to the bridge, when he suddenly realized to his horror that it was going to be nice to him, and he stopped dead. He hadn't been able to turn off the door's courtesy voice circuits. This doorway to the bridge was concealed from view within it because of the excitingly chunky way in which the bridge had been designed to curve round, and he'd been hoping to enter unobserved. He leant despondently back against the wall again and said some words which his other head was quite shocked to hear. He peered at the dim pink outline of the door and discovered that in the darkness of the corridor he could just about make out the sensor field which extended out into the corridor and told the door when there was someone there for whom it must open and to whom it must make a cheery and pleasant remark. He pressed himself hard back against the wall and edged himself towards the door, flattening his chest as much as he possibly could to avoid brushing against the very, very dim perimeter of the field. He held his breath and congratulated himself on having lain in bed sulking for the last few days, rather than trying to work out his feelings on chest expanders in the ship's gym. He then realized he was going to have to speak at this point. He took a series of very shallow breaths, and then said as quickly and as quietly as he could, "Door, if you can hear me, say so very, very quietly." Very, very quietly, the door murmured, "I can hear you." "Good. Now, in a moment, I'm going to ask you to open. When you open, I do not want you to say that you enjoyed it, okay? Okay? And I don't want you to say to me that I have made a simple door very happy, or that it is your pleasure to open for me and your satisfaction to close again with the knowledge of a job well done, okay? Okay? And I do not want you to ask me to have a nice day, understand? I understand. Okay, said Zaphod, tensing himself. Open now. The door stood open quietly. Zaphod slipped quietly through. The door closed quietly behind him.
Is that the way you like it, Mr. Babelbrooks? Said the door out loud. I want you to imagine, said Zaphod to the group of white robots who swung around to stare at him at that point, that I have an extremely powerful Killer Zap blaster pistol in my hand.
There was an immensely cold and savage silence. The robots regarded him with hideously dead eyes. They stood very still. There was something intensely macabre about their appearance, especially to Zaphod, who had never seen one before or ever known anything about them. The Cricket Wars belonged to the ancient past of the galaxy, and Zaphod had spent most of his early history lessons plotting how he was going to have sex with the girl in the cyber cubicle next to him, and since his teaching computer had been an integral part of this plot, it had eventually had all its history circuits wiped and replaced with an entirely different set of ideas, which had then resulted in it being scrapped and sent to a home for degenerate cybermats, whither it was followed by the girl who had inadvertently fallen deeply in love with the unfortunate machine, with the result A, that Zaphod never got near her, and B, that he missed out on a period of ancient history that would have been of inestimable value to him at this moment. He stared at them in shock. It was impossible to explain why, but their smooth and sleek white bodies seemed to be the utter embodiment of clean, clinical evil. From their hideously dead eyes to their powerful, lifeless feet, they were clearly the calculated product of a mind that wanted simply to kill. Zaphod gulped in cold fear. They had been dismantling part of the rear bridge wall and had forced a passage through some of the vital innards of the ship. Through the tangled wreckage, Zaphod could see,
with a further and worse sense of shock, that they were tunnelling towards the very heart of the ship, the heart of the improbability drive that had been so mysteriously created out of thin air, the heart of gold itself. The robot closest to him was regarding him in such a way as to suggest that it was measuring every smallest particle of his body, mind, and capability. And when it spoke, what it said seemed to bear this impression out. Before going on to what it actually said, it's worth recording at this point that Zaphod was the first living organic being to hear one of these creatures speak for something over 10 billion years. If he had paid more attention to his ancient history lessons and less to his organic being, he might have been more impressed by this honour. The robot's voice was like its body, cold, sleek, and lifeless. It had almost a cultured rasp to it. It sounded as ancient as it was. It said, "You do have a kilozap blaster pistol in your hand." Zaphod didn't know what it meant for a moment, but then he glanced down at his own hand and was relieved to see that what he had found clipped to a wall bracket was indeed what he had thought it was. "Yeah," he said in a kind of relieved sneer, which is quite tricky. "Well, I wouldn't want you to overtax your imagination, robot." For a while, nobody said anything, and Zaphod realised that the robots were obviously not here to make conversation, and that it was up to him. "I can't help noticing that you have parked your ship," he said, with a nod of one of his heads in the appropriate direction, "through mine." There was no denying this. Without regard for any kind of proper dimensional behaviour, they had simply materialised their ship precisely where they wanted it to be, which meant that it was simply locked through the heart of gold as if they were nothing more than two combs. Again, they made no response to this, and Zaphod wondered if the conversation would gather any momentum if he phrased his part of it in the form of questions. "Haven't you?" he added. "Yes," replied the robot. Okay, said Zaphod. So, what are you cats doing here?" Silence. Robots, said Zaphod. "What are you robots doing here?" "We have come," rasped the robot, "for the gold of the Bale." Zaphod nodded. He waggled his gun to invite further elaboration. The robot seemed to understand this. "The gold Bale is part of the key we seek," continued the robot, "to release our masters from cricket." Zaphod nodded again. He waggled his gun again. "The key," continued the robot simply, "was disintegrated in time and space. The golden Bale is embedded in the device which drives your ship. It will be reconstituted in the key. Our masters shall be released. The universal readjustment will continue." Zaphod nodded again. What are you talking about?" he said. A slightly pained expression seemed to cross the robot's totally expressionless face. He seemed to find the conversation depressing. "Obliteration," it said. "We seek the key," it repeated. "We already have the wooden pillar, the steel pillar, and the perspex pillar. In a moment we will have the gold Bale."
"No, you won't."
"We will," stated the robot.
"No, you won't. It makes my ship work."
"In a moment," repeated the robot patiently, "we will have the gold Bale."
"You will not,"
said Zaphod. "And then we must go," said the robot in all seriousness, "to a party."
"Oh," said Zaphod softly. "Can I come?"
"No," said the robot. "We are going to shoot you."
"Oh, yeah?"
said Zaphod, waggling his gun. "Yes," said the robot, and they shot him. Zaphod was so surprised they had to shoot him again before he fell down.
Chapter 12. "Shh," said Slotty Bartfast. "Listen and watch." Night had now fallen on ancient cricket. The sky was dark and empty. The only light was coming from the nearby town, from which pleasant, convivial sounds were drifting quietly on the breeze. They stood beneath a tree from which heady fragrances wafted around them. Arthur squatted and felt the informational illusion of the soil and the grass. He ran it through his fingers. The soil seemed rich and heavy, the grass strong. It was hard to avoid the impression that this is a thoroughly delightful place in all respects. The sky was, however, extremely blank, and seemed to Arthur to cast a certain chill over the otherwise idyllic, if currently invisible, landscape. Still, he supposed, is a question of what you're used to. He felt a tap on his shoulder and looked up. Slotty Bartfast was quietly directing his attention to something down the other side of the hill. He looked and could just see some faint lights dancing and waving and moving slowly in their direction. As they came nearer, sounds became audible too, and soon the dim lights and noises resolved themselves into a small group of people who were walking home across the hill towards the town. They walked quite near the watchers beneath the tree, swinging lanterns which made soft and crazy lights dance amongst the trees and grass, chattering contentedly, and actually singing a song about how terribly nice everything was, how happy they were, how much they enjoyed working on the farm, and how pleasant it was to be going home to see their wives and children, with a lilting chorus to the effect that the flowers were smelling particularly nice at this time of year, and that it was a pity the dog had died, seeing as it liked them so much. Arthur could almost imagine Paul McCartney sitting with his feet up by the fire one evening, humming it to Linda, and wondering what to buy with the proceeds, and thinking, probably Essex. "The masters of cricket," breathed Slotty Bartfast in sepulchral tones. Coming as it did so hard upon the heels of his own thoughts about Essex, this remark caused Arthur a moment's confusion. Then the logic of the situation imposed itself on his scattered mind, and he discovered that he still didn't understand what the old man meant. "What?" he said. "The masters of cricket," said Slotty Bartfast again, and if his breathing had been sepulchral before, this time he sounded like someone in Hades with bronchitis. Arthur peered at the group and tried to make sense of what little information he had at his disposal at this point. The people in the group were clearly alien, if only because they seemed a little tall, thin, angular, and almost as pale as to be white. But otherwise they appeared remarkably pleasant, a little whimsical perhaps. One wouldn't necessarily want to spend a long coach journey with them. But the point was that if they deviated in any way from being good, straightforward people, it was in being perhaps too nice rather than not nice enough. So why all this rasping lung work from Slotty Bartfast, which would seem more appropriate to a radio commercial for one of those nasty films about chainsaw operators taking their work home with them? Then this cricket angle was a tough one, too. He hadn't quite fathomed the connection between what he knew as cricket and what... Slotty Bartfast interrupted his train of thought at this point, as if sensing what was going through his mind. "The game you know as cricket," he said, and his voice still seemed to be wandering lost in subterranean passages, "is just one of those curious freaks of racial memory which can keep images alive in the mind eons after their true significance has been lost in the mists of time. Of all the races in the galaxy, only the English could possibly revive the memory of the most horrific wars ever to sunder the universe and transform it into what I'm afraid is generally regarded as an incomprehensibly dull and pointless game. Rather fond of it myself," he added, "but in most people's eyes you have been inadvertently guilty of the most grotesquely bad taste. Particularly the bit about the little red ball hitting the wicket. That's very nasty." Said Arthur, with a reflective frown to indicate that his cognitive synapses were coping with this as best they could. And these... said Slotty Bartfast, slipping back into crypt guttural and indicating the group of cricket men who had now walked past them, "are the ones who started it all, and it will start tonight. Come, we will follow and see why."
End of side 2.